All right, this is the I Am Rappaport Serial Podcast. This is Michael Rappaport, a.k.a. the Gringo Mandingo. We are actually in the mountains of Park City, Utah. Me and G. Moody, last name rhymes with duty. We got a special, fantastic interview coming up. Live interview from the mountains of Park City, Utah. You might be saying, why are you in the mountains of Park City, Utah? Well, we came out here with the L.A. Clippers. We're now the proud partner of the L.A. Clippers on a digital content initiative, the first of its kind in the NBA. The Clippers are opening their doors to me, the Gringo Mandingo, and the I Am Rappaport Stereo podcast crew to cover their team in our own unique style with no limits. And we're starting it off tonight. The Clippers are in town playing the Utah Jazz. We are in the mountains, Park City, Utah. We're getting ready to do a live stereo podcast with the great Doc Rivers. I can't even remember his first name. Doc Rivers, the coach of the LA Clippers. Doc Rivers, NBA player, Atlanta Hawks, the bruising New York Knicks. When the Garden was actually still Eden, even though we didn't win a championship. And we're kicking it off. I'm going to keep it real. This little intro opening I'm doing right now is after the interview. The interview is, I think it's one of our best. I truly think it's one of our best interviews. It's so informative, and Doc is so charismatic, and he breaks down basketball for the non-basketball fan. This is the I Am Rappaport Stereo Podcast coming live from the mountains of Park City, Utah. I am the Gringo Mandingo, G. Moody, last name rhymes with duty, and special guest, Doc Rivers. Let's get into it now. All right, the I Am Rappaport Stereo Podcast is going to be in New Orleans for All-Star Break. NBA All-Star Break is coming up. We're doing a live show at the Joy Theater Saturday, February 18th at 5:30 p.m. Doors open at 4:30. It's going to be nuts. It's New Orleans. It's NBA weekend. Me, G. Moody, live. We may or may not have special guests, but I'd hedge on the side of special guests. Saturday the 18th at the Joy Theater. Doors open at 4:30. The show starts at 5:30. Tickets are on sale at www.iamrappaporttour.com. It's going to be a doozy. Huh. Doozy rhymes with jacuzzi. All right. This is the I Am Rappaport Stereo Podcast coming live from Park City, Utah. I want to give the impression to the listeners at home that this is a sold-out packed arena. So let me get just a little bit of a round of applause.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like 300 people in here capacity. So we're happy to be working with the
Sounds
Clippers.
Sounds like a Knick game.
Yes, yes. That was a big round of applause. I got a very, very a famous comedian friend. He told me corporate crowds can be tough, but I think he's wrong about this corporate crowd. So this is going to be good. So I'm Michael Rappaport. This is my partner, Gerald Moody, G. Moody. Last name, I always have to remind people, rhymes with duty.
Yes.
We've been friends since 1982.
For sure.
We met in New York City through basketball.
Yes.
And we're 1982 was the year Doc Rivers was drafted into the NBA with the Atlanta Hawks.
Yes.
Yeah, that officially makes me really old.
Yes. Yeah. And the fact that we were friends in 82, we can remember watching. We're catching up.
Yeah, we're catching up too.
So this is a huge honor to have Doc as the guest here because I've talked to you before. Basketball. I'll just tell you a little bit about myself. I had hoop dreams when I was 12 years old. I wanted to be in the NBA. And it's not that funny, Ben.
Yeah.
Take it easy.
He's laughing.
Take it easy. But you know, we'll get right to you, Doc, because I know you've been on a road trip. And you know, I'm sure there's probably some wild parties in Utah that you guys, you and the guys.
I got to go calm the players down in Salt Lake right now.
Pull them from the clubs and all that stuff. So listen, the first time we saw you playing was
in the
on the Turner Network.
Yep.
When the games, I just happened to have cable when the games,
the Atlanta Hawks.
The Atlanta
CBS.
Hawks.
Yeah.
And so, but one of the things that I always found fascinating about your career, and it just, we were talking about AAU and the players growing up together, but when you were coming up in Chicago, there was a hotbed of young talent. So who were the other talent, in high school, junior high school that were around you in the on the west side of Chicago?
It was amazing. I was lucky. Like, at the park, on a given day. It was Isaiah Thomas, Mark Aguirre, Darryl Walker, Maurice Cheeks, Craig Hodges, Terry Cummings. I mean, we all played. We played. We had one team where Darryl Walker, Mark Aguirre, myself, and Isaiah played on the eighth grade travel team. We just traveled around Chicago, and we didn't know we were that good because at that time we were all the same. We're good, but we're good to each other. Nobody was that special. And I tell people, I didn't realize that, my goal was to make it to the NBA, and I was a hotshot high school player, but I'd never left Chicago until my senior year. I went to the BC All-American camp. You know, you get invited to these camps.
Right.
And I go, it's the first time I'd literally left the state of Chicago, drove to Wisconsin. And all of a sudden, the top 100 players there, and I was like, God, these guys aren't that good. I was playing against every day, going to that was not a big deal for me.
That's crazy.
It was earth shattering. It's really cool. Wow.
So that little crew, like you only needed four players, right? Like, did you ever lose games going around?
No, we didn't lose a lot. No, we never lost. The greatest part about that whole group was they had the Chicago Summer League, and it's where all the NBA players would come play in the summer.
Older guys.
Yeah,
who was coming?
All of them, like Artis Gilmore. I mean, every player in the NBA would come play in the summer league in Chicago because back then there was no sanction. So it was like all-star NBA players playing all on the same teams, and there was like five or six. My junior year in high school, whoever ran the tournament decided he was going to put a high school team in it. And it was I was a junior. Isaiah was a senior. Mark Aguirre, Terry Cummings, Darryl Walker, a guy named Raymond McCoy, Craig Hodges.
Wow.
I think of the 12 players, 11 of them actually made it to the NBA.
Man.
But the best part of the story is we made it to the finals.
That's crazy.
In high school.
The high school team.
Playing against these dudes.
Playing against the NBA guys. And the only bad part, I'll share this, it probably tells you a little bit about me. I got into a fight with Ricky Sobers. You remember Ricky Sobers?
Of course.
The NBA player. Because I blocked his shot. And he was so mad. I was a junior in high school and the crowd's going crazy. He pushes me down. I didn't back down. He thought I would. And then next thing you know, they're breaking us up. And, the crowd went crazy after that. And four or five years later, I make it to the league and Ricky is still there.
That's nuts.
And he still didn't like me.
That's funny. How competitive was, because we were talking over there about the AAUification of the NBA and the patty cake, and they're out there on a conga line, everybody's shaking hands and kissing, and they got custom dance. They're not even on this. These aren't even teammates.
Right.
Forget what the teammates are doing. Like guys before the games, there's
quiz. Soul Train.
Yeah.
No, I'm worried every game that DJ's going to get a delay a game. If you watch the next game, he makes it with one. I'm sitting there, I'm just amused at all the handshakes. They can't remember the play, but they can remember all the different handshakes. Right. They're doing kicks and all that stuff. It drives me nuts. But I don't say anything.
You don't say anything to them?
No.
Do you ever see them in practice working on handshakes?
Yeah, no, rehearsing.
Because where do they come up with
that?
It takes a long time to remember these handshakes.
I'm amazed by it because I've never, ever seen an NBA player practicing all this stuff. And then when they announce their name, they're doing fakes. And
right.
I'm like, when did they come up with this? Like, how did they figure it out?
And there's never a mistake.
No, they're perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's never, you've never seen them mess up. Like, it would be an internet sensation if you saw one of them trip during the handshake. So it's perfect.
That's what
it makes the Rockets look like a joke.
It's amazing. But that's where I go off, after a game, if we blow a play. I'm sorry. I use sarcasm a lot. You got the handshake right. And I'm not saying it in the language I say it in, but you messed up the play. I said, I don't get that. You guys did all the different handshakes perfectly, but we couldn't remember the play when we went out on the floor.
So going back to Chicago and after Marquette, at what point do you realize I'm going to be in the NBA? And when did that hit you? And then what was that moment? Would something happen? Was it the draft? Was it training camp?
Well, the draft didn't go well. I mean, I went out early and then fell. In the draft.
Who was in your draft class?
Darryl Walker, same guys. Right. Derek Harper was in it. Russell Cross. It was a lot of good players. I thought I was better than a lot of them, but they went in front of me. So I had to reprove myself, is how I felt. And, You know, when I went to camp with the Hawks, there were 8 guaranteed contracts at guard. I didn't have a guarantee.
Wow. So what was that training camp like?
You know, it was funny. Like, maybe I was just dumb. I swear, I never thought I wasn't going to be on the team. Like, it never crossed my mind that there was a chance that I wasn't going to make the team. But if I had been logical, there was a very good chance I wasn't going to be on the team.
And, right.
But I remember the 4th day of camp, I have all these fights. I don't know why that happened.
Yeah, what is that, man?
I don't know.
You seem so chill.
I'm chilled right now.
Who did you fight?
But Wes Matthews.
Uh-huh.
Ooh, I like Wes.
Yeah, the little one.
Yeah, little Wes, yeah.
He was one of the ones that knew that it was going to be him or I. And he kept, like, doing stuff. And I had to keep my cool because I'm trying to make the team. And finally, you know, he kept throwing elbows. And finally, I literally picked him up and slammed him. And Mike Fratello is the coach. He blows the whistle. He walks over to me and he says, "You are on the Hawks. You're good." Wow. That's it, literally 5 minutes after that. And I was thinking, well, if that's all it took.
Right.
I would have slammed him earlier.
I would have done that. Yeah. You know,
but he appreciated it.
He liked it. He thought, he told me later that he saw the guy, he kept challenging me, and he was like, is this guy going to do anything?
Right.
And I was thinking if I did something, it would put me in trouble.
Right.
So I didn't, but it got to the point where you literally had to do something or he was going to keep doing it.
I love that.
Yeah.
When you're on that team, do you remember your first oh shit moment watching the human highlight film, Dominique Wilkins?
Yes. Every practice. Wow. You know, he was amazing. Like, people have no idea how athletic. You know, when he did show dunks for game winners.
Right.
You know, when you think he did that double pump against Milwaukee.
Right.
That's the same dunk the guys are doing in the dunk contest.
Right.
He did it for a game winner.
Right.
I mean, I got dunked on more by my own teammate trying to get a rebound. if you watch those highlights, all those tip dunks, I'm up under there, you know, here. And Dominique had a great saying. He said, "Oh, you guys can go to the 4th or 5th floor, but I can jump to the penthouse." He said, "I'm the only one in the penthouse." And it was true. That's how you felt. Like, he was a supreme athlete, and he was a great offensive player.
And you talked about, you were saying over there, you know, like the work ethic. And, you know, I feel like Dominique, you know, he only gets sort of looked at as a dunker. And, you know, I mean, he was tenacious in those series versus Boston. And he took that Larry Bird challenge. Like, it seemed like there was like a Russell Westbrook-esque quality. Like, yo, these guys are all great, but now is the time I'm going to show that I'm on that level. I'm not just a dunker.
That level, but he just didn't have winning on his
right.
side, you know. But athletically and his work ethic, you know, like I was telling you over there, that the best, it's no coincidence, the best players work harder.
Right.
It's not like genetics or like it's no. If you went in our gym, Chris Paul's in the gym more than everyone else.
Right.
Blake's in the gym and works out more than everybody else.
Right.
And that's everywhere I've been. There's no one who worked harder than Kevin Garnett or Ray Allen or Paul. And it's the great players to me. You know, some have attitudes, but they're easier to coach than the average player because those are the guys that want to be great. They think they can be them, but they don't want to put in the time.
Uh-huh.
And they don't really understand who they are. And so those are the tougher guys.
And when you say work ethic, is it just working on a specific shot, running extra wind sprints, talking to the coaches, absorbing the tape a little bit more, or all of the above?
Like, I think it's all the above.
Because the technology for working out in 82, they're working out was just so you're going to run up and down the court. Yeah. Now you got all kinds of trainers.
Yeah, my day we played basketball.
That was it.
We played basketball every day.
Right.
We played all day. That's all we did. I wish they did that a little bit more because I do think you lose a little bit when you're not on. You should play basketball. That's what you do.
Right.
But, you know, my first strength coach was my 8th year in the NBA. We had a strength coach for one day. Mike Fratello fired him because he took – he hired him for the season. We had our first day in training camp, and we start stretching. And Mike's, like, pacing, like, how long is this stretch? How long is this going to take? And finally he blows his whistle. We stop. We think, and he tells, get out. He throws the strength coach out. We never saw him again.
That's funny.
That was it. Like, that was it. So when I was traded to the Clippers, they had a guy named Carl Horn. He was my first strength coach, like, every day, and I hated it. I got to lift weights.
Right.
What? I want to play basketball. Right.
Well, so basketball. Back in your, when you guys were playing, there wasn't like a big weight
room? No.
Like, if you did, if guys did that, like, Kevin Willis. Now, he looked like he lifted some weights.
Kevin lifted and did sit-ups.
Did
and,
he bring them in himself? Like, did he carry them like in a duffel bag?
Kevin had his own stuff. Sidney Moncrief gets the most. Sidney Moncrief gets the credit for being the guy that started the NBA. Him and Kermit Washington.
Okay.
Are the two guys that started the NBA in lifting. And Sidney would lift on game days, and you were like, and then when you played against Sidney, you realize, oh, something, he's stronger than me.
Right.
I got to do something.
Right.
And that's when, you know, you start doing weights. Right. But we did, like, health club weights. You know, when you sit at and you're doing this with your legs and you're watching.
Jack O'Lane stuff.
That's all we did. Like, right. You know, our practice facility was at a health club, and I literally, before every practice, I would do the weights, and then I would go play. That was it. No stretch. Right. I'm amazed more guys didn't get injured.
I'm going to jump forward because the other night you were in New York, you were at a fight, and then a basketball game broke out.
A fight in the garden.
Yeah. So it's the first quarter of the game.
Yeah.
It's early in the game. People are just, my popcorn, like I, for some reason, I had a feel like I walked my dog and I was like, I want to get home and watch this entire game. You know, a lot of times you can't watch every game, even from, you know, for the Knicks versus the Clippers. But I was like, I had a feeling like I wanted to watch this game. Tell me what you were seeing and how that transpired. And was that one of the oddest things you've ever seen during
it? It was sad, number one, but it was odd. It was crazy. I mean, I'm standing near half court, and I look up, and I can see Charles Oakley standing there, and I can see the commotion. And so if you ever look, I walked way past. I was almost towards it. I wouldn't go help him, but I saw it was Charles. You know, Charles Oakley and I played together. And a very good friend and a good teammate. So I take three steps down, and one of the refs saw me and told me, no, he literally pointed, no, like, get back. And then I tell him to stop the game. I said, stop the game. Charles Oakley's having a fight, you know.
Right.
Like, stop the game. So he stops the game, and I didn't realize it was security. I didn't know what was going on.
Right.
And then I saw what it was, and it really bothered me. I was really sad because I didn't know, but it looked bad. I saw them take them down to the ground.
Right.
And it was just a bad look. Then after the game, you know, you hear all the stuff. And the Knicks, their press release was horrendous.
Right,
you know,
I agree.
About, you know, mental health, and which you don't know that, and you shouldn't do that. That's the only thing that upset me.
Right.
But then I've talked to Charles. I talked to him yesterday. Talked to him that night, and, you know, but that was a strange event, strange night.
So talk to me about that team, because you were telling me, like, you talked to Charles, like, that New York Knicks team, which, you know, for those of you who, you know, as a New Yorker, it couldn't have been more ironic, and the metaphor of Charles Oakley, who represented everything that it meant and still hopefully means to be a Knick, hardworking, tough-nosed, lunch pail, not the gentrified Manhattan or the hipster Brooklyn, the New York, not the New York you see in Sex and the City. The majority of New Yorkers are just 9-to-5ers trying to, you know,
he
make
was
a living
on our train. Team. Like,
and the irony of him, it was almost like he was like a fan was living through him, because with the frustration of the Knicks. But that team that you played on with the Masons and Patrick,
we had the toughest team. I mean, they changed rules because of that team.
Yeah.
You know, literally, the NBA has played the way it's played because, you know, Riley had a great rule. He had two rules. One, if you picked up an opposing player, it was a $500 fine.
You picked him up that was real.
Yeah, that was a $500 fine. Like, if a player fell on the other team, you'd reach down to pick him up, $500.
He told you that.
Yeah, and we had one team fight against Charlotte because
you were in that.
Well, I was in the Phoenix fight.
Oh, right, the Phoenix fight. Yeah.
But the Charlotte one was Rolando Blackman was picking Larry Johnson up and remembered halfway and let him go. So Larry Johnson jumps up, and he's like, you know, it's a fight.
That's funny.
But the other rule would Riley believe, if you foul every possession in the first 5 minutes, the ref would stop calling. And that was his big thing, like literally foul them every time down the floor the first 5 minutes of the game, and then the game's a war because the refs, they can't keep calling. And it was true. Like,
strategy.
You know, after about 5 minutes, you were just killing the other team.
Yeah.
And it was no whistle.
Yeah, that's great.
It was awesome. But, you know, they changed rules and that went away. But that team was close. Starks, and I heard from Starks and Ewing and Greg Anthony, you know, obviously Mason is no longer with us.
Right.
Charles Smith called, Patrick Ewing called. I mean, they all wanted to know how Mace was. I mean, or how Oak was. Yeah. And I just thought that was really cool. I like close teams, you know. That's what I want here. Like, if you can create more than a team, you have a chance when things go bad to get through it.
Right.
You know, like you have equity
right.
in each other. And like the Boston team, you know, we had this Mbutu thing going that it's a South African word. A person is a person through other people. I can't be all I can be unless you are. I need you to be great so I can be great. That
right.
was like our whole thing in Boston. And, you know, Tony Allen, we're playing Memphis, you know, and Tony's stretching. I walk by and he grabs my hand and says, Mbutu. I mean, so it's like still in that group. Kevin Garnett is with us now, and he's
right.
trying to get our guys to understand, like, that's not fake. You have to actually believe that. And, you know, the equity that you use up, because you're going to have bad moments. You're
going
right. to have bad streaks, you know, and when you are closer, you can yell at each other more.
Right.
You know, you can get on each other more.
There's a trust that you could take.
Trust.
You could hear
like,
it better.
I could literally say, you know, in Boston to Kevin, like, Kevin, you're awful tonight in front of the whole team. And Kevin would say, I was, my fault, you know. But when you're not close, it's harder.
Now, Kevin Garnett, who now is with the Clippers.
He's on the road right now.
So when he's one of my favorite players. Obviously, he's one of everybody's favorite players, even if he wasn't your favorite. You had to respect the tenacity. He'd be out there sometimes talking almost to himself. When Kevin Garnett played, what the hell is he talking about all the time?
I have no idea.
He never shut up.
No,
is he talking to himself? Is he like reciting poems?
I honestly, first of all, I thought it was fake when I, because I'd never coached him. And then when he came to Boston, I never thought there's no way someone can be this crazed. Like, it's impossible that they could have this much energy. And like after practice two, you realize, holy goodness, this dude is nuts. Mm-hmm. Like, his energy and his intensity in practice, you know, he would not allow you to take him out. And for 2 years, Kevin Garnett did not miss 1 second of practice. He didn't believe. He believed that he used to, you know, I used to look at him like he's crazy. But he used to tell me, Warriors, don't miss a second. If the head chief misses, then everyone else sees it, and that makes them weak. And I would think, Kevin, you need to go sit down for 10 minutes to get some rest, you know, but he would not. So if you took him out, he would run on the side and mock whatever his guy was doing. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen.
And it's not for show.
Like if I took him out of practice and scrimmaging, whatever his guy did, he would do. So he would be running on the side. If a guy's jumped, he would jump. If a guy was sliding, he would slide. And you're sitting there like, What the heck is
Google's
this guy this. Doing? And so I call him over and I said, Kevin, this is why I took you out to sit down. He said, I'm not going to sit down. It's a show of weakness. That was his whole thing. And I loved him because he hated the opponent. Literally hated the opponent. Like, and I love that. You know?
Speaking of hating the opponent, I mean, I Doc, honestly, first of all, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you letting me take the time to do this.
Yes.
I know it's the last night of a road trip, and you know, we said it was gonna be short, but
oh,
they lied.
Care.
You're not going.
Yeah. I'm good.
No, but I can't tell you, like, my heart is racing. Like, I feel like I'm at a Michael Jackson concert.
We watch you all the time.
And you're just, this is, I love this. You had a bunch of personalities. Forget the obvious ones, the Kevin Garnett, which that just seems like a whole other thing to itself. Big Baby. Who I actually, and tell me if you want to co-sign this. I know you're in the league now still, but I want to change Boogie Cousins to Big Baby Cousins because I think he's literally the biggest baby ever.
Yeah,
and let me stay focused.
I agree with that.
Let me stay focused. He doesn't seem to want to gravitate to the nickname. I put it out there publicly, but he still thinks, I think he likes Boogie. But you had Big Baby. You have Kevin Garnett. Ray Allen seems chill and very professional. He hasn't had a hamburger since he, you know, started playing, you know, high-level basketball. And then you have Rondo, and you have Scalabrine.
Tony Allen,
who's a legitimate tough guy.
Yeah. Now it was the toughest group I've ever coached. Not meaning tough to coach, but meaning you had Leon Poe,
right,
who no one bothered in practice. Like, they used to call him, he was a grown man. No one bothered him. You know, we had Kendrick Perkins,
right.
You know, Kevin Garnett,
right.
Tony Allen. It was just tough. Even P.J. Brown,
right.
Like, we had guys that you wouldn't mess with,
right.
And we got along great, but there were some crazy things with that. I mean, Rondo, there was some that year. You know, we went 66 that year. It was the easiest basketball, craziest group. We had fights. There were so many things that happened during that season that was just, it was crazy.
Give me your best Celtics story from that crazy. I think I was talking to Scalabrine there at one point during the season. I don't know which year it was. It might have been the first or second year. I'm not sure. But the title, when you were going against the Lakers, there was an arm wrestling thing.
That's the craziest story.
Give it to me.
Me and Paul were talking about this the other day. So I came up with this idea on the plane to turn the plane into the locker room. Because if you guys have ever been in the NBA locker room, there's media. The guys can't ever, like, have their own time. So I decided on the airplane, you can play music as loud as you want. I mean, that plane with the Celtics was a zoo. I mean, it was a zoo. One time I hear all this screaming in the back of the plane, and I go back, because we used to call it Animal Kingdom. Like, you didn't even go back there. It was just not worth it. And Kevin, Baby, Leon, they all have their shirts off. They're sweating like they're playing in a pickup game. And I'm looking, and they're arm wrestling. And I'm like, I don't like this. Someone's going to get hurt. So they divide up teams, and Big Baby is like, bam, everybody, bam. I mean, it was crazy how quick. You know, we got to Leon Poe, who we thought, bam. And Kevin Garnett on the other side was winning, but it was a struggle. So the championship was Big Baby versus Kevin Garnett. And I walked back and said, no, this is not going to happen. Because, you know, someone's going to get hurt.
Plane could go down.
Yeah, I thought someone's, like, shoulder would get thrown out. And they said, no, we're going to do it. We're going to come on, coach, please. So I said, all right. And I sit there and watch it. And Baby starts, and Kevin stares at him. And Baby, Kevin won.
Wow.
It was the crazy. Like, Paul Pierce brought it up to the players 2 days ago. We were talking about the most toughest mentally thing we've ever seen in our life. There's no way that Kevin Garnett can beat Baby. There's no way that can happen. And he literally beat him mentally. Like, he wouldn't give in. Like, at the beginning, Baby almost had him down. Kevin wouldn't give in. And he held it and held it. I mean, it lasted for a minute.
And people are going crazy.
And they're sweating. And then finally, Kevin gets him. And we were like, I was shocked. I was like, what just happened? And the funny part was, Kevin would not stop staring at him. He was staring at him the whole time. Looking at him. And we're like,
he knew he had to win that match, right, to, like, beat the
guess, but I thought, even if he knew he had, he was going to get hurt. No way. Baby, it's humongous.
Right.
Yeah.
And I tell people, of all the things I've seen in basketball, the most mentally tough thing I've ever seen was arm wrestling competition, because it was impossible for him to win.
So what is Garnett bringing to the L.A. Clippers now? As he's an assistant?
He's a special assistant.
And so what is he bringing? Like, what is his role?
His role is undefined, but his role is really DJ.
Okay.
You know, for me, that's his role. Now, he ends up working with Blake, too, which is a bonus. But his role for me is DJ.
Like, working on offensive moves?
Working on offensive moves and work on them, really his mental. Like, the mental toughness. Like, don't give in to refs. Don't give in to players. Don't get frustrated. You know, and DJ does. That's his, you know,
right.
If he has an Achilles, that's it. You can get to him.
Right.
And, you know, Kevin just talks to him and they work. The other thing is, you know, he's making DJ work. DJ is naturally a good player, but Kevin is teaching him what a work ethic is.
Right.
And, you know, Kevin gets there early. You know, it's great. Like, we have an 11 o'clock practice and Kevin's there at 8:30 and he wants DJ to be there. And
wow.
DJ is there now. DJ would have been there at 11, you know, for 12. Now he's there at 8:30, and when practice starts, he's already been on the floor an hour and a half, 2 hours.
And KG's out there working, sweating.
He's working him. He is working them. And he's been great for Bryce and Diamond as well.
Right.
But my goal was DJ. Like, all the other stuff is gravy.
Right.
My whole goal with him, and I told Kevin, that's your guy.
Right.
Like, we got to make him a bigger threat.
Right. Go ahead, G.
Now, who's the best player you played against that you would think is the best?
Well, Michael or Magic.
Right.
You know,
that you competed against.
Because, you know, Bird was a three, so I never played against him.
Right.
Dominique would say Bird.
Right,
somebody
right.
Somebody like that. But I had to guard Michael and Magic. And
wow.
Magic was harder for me. Because Michael, you know, yeah, you're just too big. You felt like you're, like, you know, what we call daddy ball when you play your little kids.
Right.
You back them down. Right. That's how you felt wow. when you're playing against Magic. Like, you didn't have an impact on them. You know, like, I was a defensive player. I could get under Michael's skin, you know.
How did you do that?
Just be physical, you know, hit his arm a couple of times, get away with it. You know, I had some good defensive games against Michael.
Right.
He had some good offensive games against
of
me,
course,
too.
Yeah.
You know, the best Michael story, and this is true, we played them back-to-back. I held him at that time. It was his career low to, like, 12. And he walked by our locker room and stuck in and just said, Doc, great job tonight. Wow. And then he left. That was all he said.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
He just made a point of letting me know.
Right.
And, you know, and all the players were like, oh, tomorrow you're going to get it. You know, you're going to get it.
You're going to get 80 tomorrow.
Yeah, and I think he had like 46 the next night. But, you know, that's why I didn't take credit that night. Like, no, that was a team effort. Yeah, but, you know, when you guard guys like that, you're thinking they're great, but not tonight. That was my whole thing. Like, they're great, but not tonight.
Mm,
you know, and that's what I would always say. And sometimes they were still great.
Right, right.
That you can do about it.
When you were watching Dominique and the Bird Wars, because you didn't notice it on TV, and the way the games, the technology of the games now, maybe you would see it. But, like, I remember talking to Dominique, and he has such a reputation now as a trash talker. Larry Bird, maybe you would see it in this day and age with Instagram and everything.
Yeah, Larry was the biggest trash talker in the league.
Tell me how? Why, what was he doing
good.
It quietly?
Yeah, it was good trash. Now it's TV trash, you know.
Right.
But his trash was great. Like, you know, me, I wasn't a scorer. I could score, but I, you know, I was more of a point guard. You know, I remember the one game I was having, I think I had 37, but early in the game I had a lot of points, and Larry on the free throw would walk up to you, man, you're playing well. See how long that, see if you can, like, can you keep doing that? Like, that's not really you. he would say stuff like that to you, and you would want to say, it is me, you know, I'm stupid. But you looked at him, you knew what he was up to.
Right.
Know, once you start thinking about it, or, you know, so he didn't do dirty trash talk. He did mental warfare.
Right.
You know, which I actually like better.
There's that that clip, I believe you were on the Hawks, where he was lighting the Hawks up.
Yeah.
And the bench, the Hawks bench, it's like a famous.
Thank God I was on the floor.
Tell about that clip.
Well, Bird had 61 against us. In the last 20, he was calling his shots.
Like, what do you mean?
He was calling the shot. He was coming down off the glass.
He's saying that out
on
loud.
On the free throw line, coming, you know, next shot, 3-point left side. I mean, he was
wow.
literally calling the shots. I mean, it was crazy. So
that's like a horror movie.
Yeah, and so it was a horror movie.
Yeah.
So the last shot he made, he said, shot in trainer's lap. That was the shot where he faded away. He had to get over there. That's what, you know, I killed Dominique. He said, trainer's lap. Why'd you even let him over there? You know.
Like, he knew he wanted that shot.
Yeah, so he took a fadeaway and he fell in our trainer's lap and made it.
Oh,
and that's
man.
When our bench went crazy.
Because he made the shot. It was like as
shot.
If he was on your team.
So Mike Fratello, the next day for film, we watched, you know, back then there was, you rewind, we didn't have clips. We watched 20 times just the bench. He was so mad that the bench, mm-hmm. 20 over and over. You saw Eddie Johnson, I can remember a guy named Ricky Brown. They're all giving each other high fives. And you know, we lost the game. The guy has 61 and our own team is giving each other high fives. That was not good.
I've always loved Fratello. And like I told you, you know, watching that team, it was weird because you'd watch the Knicks in New York. You didn't have NBA packages. And then I had this affection for the Atlanta Hawks. Obviously, the Dominique factor. And you, yeah, I mean, you guys were, it was an exciting team. And you had this short, crazy coach, Mike Fratello, who I love listening talk basketball.
No, he's like, a genius.
Because he makes it for not just the basketball fan.
Yeah.
Like, he'll make it accessible for anybody. What did you take away that now that you're a coach from Fratello, from the Rileys? Like, and talk to me, like, so talk to me about, like, Fratello and then the other coaches that you took away and now, like, influenced the way you coach.
Yeah, listen, I was lucky. You know, even going back to college with Rick Majerus,
yep,
Hank Raymond's. I have Mike Fratello is my first coach. Larry Brown is my second coach.
Wow.
Pat Riley is my third coach. You know, and then Popovich and you know, Bob Hill was the coach, but Popovich was the president at the time.
Right.
So I was like in coaching heaven my entire day.
Right.
Like I had great coaching.
Right.
Fratello was his defense. You know, and I still do a lot of his. You know, some of the things that he does. So his philosophy defensively. I take the most of that from him.
Well, explain the basics of that defensive philosophy that Fratello talked about that you
know, Michael, Mike's and Ryle's very similar. Their whole thing is transition. You know, like my teams have never been a great offensive rebounding team because statistically it's proven that if you can get back and set over going for the glass, that you will make more points and save more points.
Right.
And so that was Mike's big thing, his transition D.
Right.
And Mike's big thing is no middle.
Don't let him come down the middle.
Don't let him in the middle of the floor. Try to keep the offense on the sides.
Okay. And what is the point of that?
Because the middle, you can see the whole floor. The sides, you can only see half the floor.
Right.
When I'm going driving baseline, this whole side of the floor is taken out visually.
Right.
You know, for 98%. Of the players. Magic and LeBron, they see the whole floor anyway.
So guarding the point, so it's really like whoever's guarding the point, push them to a side.
Push them to the side. They call a pick and roll, force it to the side.
Got it.
You know, the only time we force middle, we're going to trap.
Okay.
That's all for Fratello and Riley. Because Riley and Dick Harder was Riley's, really the worst name ever, Dick Harder. But that's all.
His name is Dick Harder or Dick Carter?
No, Dick Harder.
Dick Harder?
Dick Harder?
Yeah.
He still didn't get it changed?
No, I never changed.
At some point, mom's got to do him change it to Peter. Then that's not good either, Peter Harder.
No, that's bad, too. Either way. But so Riley, I got that. Larry Brown.
You should change his name to Seal or something.
I know.
Boogie Knight's character.
Larry Brown was his attention to detail. Riley affected me more than anybody.
How so? And
he was a team builder.
In what way?
Riley's whole belief was anybody can X and O. But if you can get your team to function as a group, like I was convinced we were going to win the title when I was with the Knicks. There was no question about it. And that was all Riley. Like Riley had this ability to, his speeches were, you've heard about them.
Right.
They were phenomenal. Like, I'd never heard, like, Larry and Mike were good, but Riles was like listening to the, you know, Martin Luther King or Gandhi speak every game. I mean, he did different things, like the one where he put his head in this bucket of water and he wouldn't take it out. I mean, literally wouldn't take it out.
Whoa, hold on a second. So, he's the coach.
Before the game, he comes in and he's talking about commitment and trust. And you know how he would say it. And he sticks his head in his bucket of water. I mean, me and Starks, we sat next to each other. We're like, what the hell? Is he going to come out? Is he going to come out? And finally, like, Patrick grabbed him. I mean, his eyes are watering. It's not. He said, I wasn't coming out until somebody saved me. And I knew somebody was going to save me. I knew somebody was going to. And I'm thinking, yeah, I wouldn't take that chance. You know, but it was amazing. Like, you sit there and snot. I mean, you're like, what the heck? It was crazy.
So the Showtime Lakers coach of Riley, the image that you saw, the hair back,
all
the gray. He's a tough guy.
No, he's a tough. You know, from Schenectady, New York. He was a tough dude, like smoked cigarettes. I mean, every image I had of Pat Riley was a race. You know, when you're around him, you know, he did a film before the Portland game, and we were the most physical team in the league. He said we were soft. So he walks in, he puts on this film, and it's of car accidents, of Rams running each other, of knockouts. I mean,
scared straight.
And he just sit there, and then he leaves. Didn't say a word. And I'm looking at like Mason and Oakley, and I'm like, oh my gosh, they're gonna kill someone tonight. Like they're gonna kill someone tonight. And that was Riles. He had this ability though to do it in a team way, not individual. And it was never about the game. It was always about the whole year.
I love it.
He was the best.
Changed me. I could imagine. Yeah. You might have like PTS like for that. Like I mean,
no, that changed me. That made me want to coach. Like without Riles, I never coached. It made me like, man, I want to be that. I want to be a team builder.
Was her like you talk about? You hear stories about his practices being hard.
They're ridiculous.
Why? Yeah.
They're too long.
And was it scrimmaging?
That's the other thing I took for him. I will never have a Riley practice.
Because, but like, was it running wind sprints?
4 hours of, like, first of all, you can't go more than three now. That's an NBA rule. But our practices were 3 and 4 hours of just constant running, defending, running. And, you know, I was down to what I knew I was cramping. And you remember in the playoffs, I kept cramping.
Right.
Because I got below the level. Body fat. Humanly, you shouldn't be below 3.5. And I got to 3. And I didn't know any better. I didn't know what that was. But I was cramping every night in every game. You remember every game?
Yeah.
My legs, my body, because once you get under that number, you burn muscle. And so I learned that the hard way. The greatest part about that was you had to eat. Like, during the playoffs, I was eating like Big Macs, and I couldn't eat enough food because they were trying to get back up. But it was due to those darn practices. And I thought that hurt us. Like, that was the only – and he admitted that with that group, we were too old. That's not the group to do in the middle of a playoff series. You shouldn't be having four-hour practice.
Right.
And he still would, and it came back and haunted us.
Gamertag Radio is headed to E3 2017.
E3 is one of the biggest events for Gamertag Radio, and you don't want to miss this.
Join hosts Danny Pena, Paris Lilly, and Peter Toledo direct from the convention center floor.
What are the plans for Microsoft? We're going to see more new titles from Sony PlayStation. And how about Nintendo? Interviews, roundtable discussion, previews, hand-on impressions, and more.
E3 2017 coverage on Gamertag Radio.
June 11th through the 15th. GamertagRadio.com or play.it/Gamertag.
Now, this is my last Knicks question, then I want to get to the current L.A. Clippers. One of the most beloved Knicks, Patrick Ewing, one of the toughest, fiercest players in all of history.
Yes.
The face of the Knicks for so long, the scowl. He's now doing shot charts on the Charlotte Hornets for Frank the Tank Kaminsky. Is Pat Ewing ever going to be a head coach?
I don't know.
It breaks our heart to see him doing Frank the Tank Kaminsky. He's doing shot charts.
Kaminsky's gonna be good.
He's good, but I'm saying, but I mean, we got the. He looks like he looks like a deer.
I love.
Yeah. What happened to Patrick Scowl?
Derek Fisher coached the Knicks,
and Patrick Ewing is down there doing shot charts for Frank the Tank.
Yeah, that's a Nick problem, clearly.
Yes.
I have nothing to do with that.
Right. And you know he wants it so bad.
No, he does, and he's earned it. He's worked on it. He's been under several coaches, so I hope so, would be my answer.
Okay. Now, did you watch the game last night, the much talked about? Like, it was a soap opera.
Yeah, they built it out. I mean, they almost made Oklahoma fans boo.
Yeah. They had a choice. They had to make a choice.
They kept saying they have to boo. And I was shocked. Like, Oklahoma, they're the nicest people in the world.
Right.
I swear. Like, it's crazy. When we played them in the playoffs with the Clips, usually when you're in an opposing city, people say bad stuff to you. You know, Lawrence Frank, your guy, will tell you, I had a ritual when I was in Boston that no matter where the arena was on shoot-around, I was going to walk from shoot-around to the hotel. Well, it's usually you're close enough to the hotel, it's not a big deal. When we played Philly, we stayed at the Four Seasons, and the hotel, it was 7.5-mile walk. And so I'm walking. Oh, it was Flip, actually. Flip Saunders was with – he was fired. So he just joined my staff just for the playoffs. And we lose game 5. So we had to go to game 6. And Flip walks in. He's pissed. He's like, damn. I said, what's wrong, man? We're gonna go win. He said, no, it's the walk. We gotta walk again back after shoot-around. But Oklahoma fans never – and the fans in the Philly are yelling nasty stuff.
They're animals out there.
They're crazy.
I was there when they booed Kobe in the All-Star game, and they stayed to boo him.
Yeah, no, they just come to boo. Where in Oklahoma, they wish you good luck. most of the time in an opposing city, a fan will wish you good luck and then say, but I hope you lose, or but I'm, they don't say that.
Right.
They say, hey, Doc, good luck tonight. And you're like, you're waiting for the rest. It's nothing.
Right.
So anyway, I didn't see the game. I saw the highlights, and I kind of liked it. There was some vinegar in the game. I think that was good. You know, Russell Westbrook had a knife in a bazooka fight.
Right.
You know, so he wasn't going to win the game.
Right.
But at least I liked that they clearly have a problem.
Right.
And so instead of being fake, you saw it. And to me, I think that's good. Now it's over. We know they actually had a problem.
Right.
And so it's over.
Do you remember all, like if I brought up a so-and-so game? Like,
yeah, I remember games. Yeah, I can't remember scores.
From like, how far back do you remember when you were playing? Do you remember, like, Boston games? Like, do you remember, like, game four versus the Lakers? And
yeah, I can remember games that I played in. I can remember every game that I coached.
That's crazy. Yeah. Well, do you dream basketball?
Yeah, I think back. I have a pad by my bed, and I write plays. I get up at night. Coaches don't sleep much because it's hard to turn off. If every coach told me that, taking it, they said, you're going to love the job, but you won't sleep well.
Because your mind is always racing,
you can't
thinking.
Turn it off. It's impossible to turn it off.
Even when things are going good?
Yeah, more when they're going good. You know, it's just the way it is. Yeah.
And when do you, so like, let me ask you this, your schedule now, like you're going to go back to Salt Lake City. Okay. You're going to go to sleep. You wake up tomorrow. What, tell me, like, just your schedule of.
Well, tomorrow I'll wake up and I'll meet with the video guys.
At what time?
At about 8:00.
Okay.
8:30. And we'll, I already have it done. I actually did it on the way here because my ride was a little longer than I anticipated. And so I'll give them the clips from the New York game, or no, who did we play last? Charlotte game.
Right.
Clips from the last time we played Utah, which was actually game two. So you got to be careful with that because both teams have changed. And then clips from the Boston-Utah game last night. So since last night, I've watched our game against them.
The whole game?
Yeah, you watched
commercial
the whole
free.
Game. Yeah, no commercial.
You had that special NBA coach hookup.
Yeah, no sound.
I heard about that special.
No sound, no commercials.
So it's just the game, and
it's just the game, and it's no free throws. You just go straight game.
Okay, you know? Cool. So you can pull clips.
Yeah, you can just put. All you do is push, and you do offense, defense. I send the defensive stuff to Brendan O'Connor.
Okay.
Our defensive guys send the offensive stuff to Woody and Armon Hill. And then we all meet, and we make an edit. And the edit of the last game is I try to do positive, all the good things we did in the Charlotte game, and show a couple of things that we got to do better, offense, defensively. I show all the things that Utah will try to do against us.
Okay.
And then I show, like, if the Boston game is just for me.
Right.
And I don't want, like I told you, I don't want my players thinking too much, you know. But what I try to look for is something that Boston did that's similar to what we do that we can do to Utah. And now, the same thing the other way around.
And then so you'll, this is at 8:00. And then walk me through the rest of the day.
So then the coaches, we'll have a coaches meeting at 9:30. We'll have a player meeting at 10:30 where we watch the film.
For how long?
20 minutes.
Okay.
And then we go right to the arena and they shoot. Then we walk through the 6 plays and their tendencies. Then we walk through 5 plays that we think will be effective against them, 5 of our own plays. Then I'll do like 3 ATOs, ATOs after timeouts.
Okay.
You know, but I don't.
And what is an ATO?
It's called an after timeout play, like a play that you don't run.
Okay.
And I do it a little different than a lot of coaches. I'm thinking about a month from now.
Right.
Like, so my ATOs that I'm running in practice, I may not run those in the game. I may run other ones in the game. I'm just trying to see how they look.
Right.
For me. And it has, sometimes it's game specific. Sometimes I'm thinking this could be a great play in the playoffs.
When you come to a timeout, when you come to a timeout and it's 13 seconds versus whoever,
yeah.
You're not coming, it's not off the cuff.
No, I have that sheet that I look at, but I don't really, you know what you're going to run. It's something that
you
see.
And they've heard it, they've run it before in practice.
Most times. Like the group in Boston, I could run a play they've never seen before, and they could run it. This is not that group. You wouldn't do that, especially without Chris. You wouldn't even think about that. And that's where, like, people don't understand when you have a key guy out, especially if it's a point, it takes away your ATOs.
Okay.
Like, it literally does. You got to be really careful running anything that they haven't seen before. And the other thing you have to be careful with is this group hasn't played together.
Right.
Like, there's, you know, Chris and JJ and Blake, they can run all kinds of stuff.
Right.
Austin, Raymond, and Jamal, they don't know that same package. So you just, it really, if you have 100 plays, it takes it down to 20.
Like, I got
you're limited to those 20 plays. You do become more predictable.
Right.
But at least they can run them.
Right.
And so you stay into that little box.
One question.
What?
Who's the best shooter you've seen? Is it Steph Curry or?
Oh, seen. I think. Yeah, I mean, I guess Curry, off the, you know, because he can do it off the dribble.
Right.
You know, but Ray Allen was unbelievable. Right. You know, Reggie Miller was unbelievable. So they're all great. But I think Curry, if you put in the dribbling part, you know, the old people think, you know, like Pistol Pete, you know, they always throw his name in. I'm not that old. I don't remember that. But they would reference him similar to Curry. I don't remember seeing Pistol play that way, so I don't know that. But that's the name I hear the most from the older guys.
Really?
Like they say, well, off the dribble shooting, Pistol Pete could do what Curry could do. But I didn't see him, so I don't know.
All right. This is my quick and final question, because I don't even know the answer. I'm thinking just now, I don't know the answer. Glenn Doc Rivers, how did the nickname Doc Rivers? I had to think for a second, Glenn, right? Yeah, Glenn Doc.
Yeah, Glenn's my name.
I mean, some people in there probably like, oh, shit, I never knew that.
Yeah, Doc came from basketball camp. Al McGuire and Rick Majerus were at the camp. I had a T-shirt on of Dr. J. And Al McGuire, last day of the camp, the Milwaukee Bucks came in, and they only had 9 guys. They needed a 10th guy. And Al looks up in the stands of campers. I'm one of the campers. And he says, Doc, come down. I didn't know who Doc was. I mean, he's looking around. I'm looking around. Who's Doc? You know, I didn't know he was talking about me. And he got mad. He's like, Doc, you. And as I came down, all the kids started yelling, Doc. And so it stuck in Milwaukee. Like, when I went back home to Chicago, I was still Glenn. When I signed in Marquette in Chicago, it said Glenn Rivers signs to go to Marquette. In Milwaukee, it said Doc Rivers. Because that's all Al McGuire ever called me. He would not call me Glenn. And then Rick Majerus would not. They always called me Doc. So when I got to college is where it started. Yes, yes. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Once upon a time, there was a new crossover that refused to play by the rules. It flipped the script and made all the others look like fools. Featuring styling that's sexier by far and handles like a rock star. Introducing the first ever Toyota CHR.
Enjoy agile handling in the body of a seductive crossover that comes with standard 18-inch alloy wheels. The first ever Toyota CHR. The perfect ride to spin your own tale. Toyota. Let's go places.